my dear friends. This question is central for the Christian faith. It's perhaps the most important question that can be asked of any believer or group of believers. And we need to remember that Jesus was executed as a common criminal under Roman law, supposedly for sedition. Crucifixion was the standard method of capital punishment of the day, and that's how Jesus died. Now, we have evidence, some in the New Testament, mostly out of it, that some of the early Christians were ashamed of the cross. They were slightly embarrassed that their Lord had suffered the death of a common criminal. But this, of course, is not the attitude of the New Testament. Paul himself says explicitly that we preach Christ crucified, though he was well aware of the fact that to the Jews this was a stumbling block, and to the Greeks it was foolishness. But he was not ashamed of the death of Christ, and it was central to his gospel. Well, for a long time, many centuries in fact, if Christians were asked why Christ was crucified, they would give a short answer, something like this: Christ's death was a sacrifice for sin. But that answer is largely unintelligible to 20th century audiences. The idea of blood sacrifices, particularly human sacrifice, has become totally repugnant. It's not part of our culture. We have no intuitive understanding of the network of ideas that would support such an idea. It seems to us totally alien and strange. In a way, it puts the clock back to things that we hoped we'd forgotten and grown out of. The idiom of Christ as a high priest entering the holy place, bearing a bowl of his own blood, only makes sense if you have a thorough knowledge of the law of Moses and the principles it enshrines. And without that background, it sounds decidedly odd, very peculiar, seemingly unacceptable. Now, I think there is a sacrificial element in the death of Christ, but it would take a long time to make this clear, and that's not my purpose this evening. Instead, I want to pick up two ideas that are suggested for us in this second chapter of Hebrews that our chairman read a few moments ago. Let's look at these verses a little more closely. Hebrews 2 and verse 5. The writer says, "It was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere, 'What is man that thou art mindful of him? Or the son of man that thou carest for him? Thou didst make him a little while lower than the angels. Thou hast crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything under his feet.'" And that's a quotation from the 8th Psalm. And the 8th Psalm, in turn, is a kind of commentary on the first chapter of Genesis, where we read right at the beginning of the Bible that man was made in the image of God, and God said to man, "Exercise dominion over the fowl of the air, the fish of the sea, and the beasts of the dry land." All of creation is given into the hand of man. Man is to exercise sovereignty over God's creation. And this is a very interesting idea. It's one that we've only just caught up with in our modern talk about the environment. we're only just beginning to realize the extent to which man has misused that dominion, the extent to which we have plundered the planet. A mixture in roughly equal parts of greed and carelessness has produced the extinction of many species of animals that we now deeply regret allowing to pass off the face of the earth. We have founded an industrial society which is based upon the principle of exhausting the earth's natural resources in the shortest possible time whilst putting nothing back. And so one could go on. But that's not the line I want to emphasize. Because the real point of this psalm is not simply, as it were, an interpretation of Genesis 1. It's a kind of reinterpretation of Genesis 1. Because the point that it makes is that when God put the world under the control of man, he had in mind one specific man. He had in mind a kind of prototype of man. Not Adam, or any of those others like him who came afterwards, but the man who was in fact the Son of God himself. See what the writer says in verse 9. Let's pick up the middle part of verse 8 again. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. As it is, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. But we see Jesus, who for a little while was made lower than the angels, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Well, that's an interesting verse. And he goes on in verse 10. It was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through suffering. Well, the first point then is that Jesus is preeminently the one who is made in the image of God. He is preeminently the one to whom the dominion over the entire creation of God's hand is committed. He is the one who is fitted and qualified in every sense to rule the world in righteousness on God's behalf. And this is the inner message, as it were, buried deeply in that first chapter of the book of Genesis, the opening chapter of the Bible. All creation is subject to him. And this, of course, explains why when Jesus came, he had no difficulty performing miracles. He could heal the sick. He could feed the hungry. He could raise the dead. He could still the storm. Of course he could. What else would you expect of a man into whose hand had been given all power over the creation of God? He was the one whom God had appointed to rule, to have dominion. And he's merely showing in the miracles that he performed before his incredulous disciples an exercise of the power that was rightfully his as part of his birthright. Well, why was he so crowned with glory and honor? Well, part of the answer is, of course, that he was born the Son of God. But you notice that the writer to the Hebrews doesn't emphasize that particular point here. He uses a different kind of argument. Look again at verses 9 and 10. He was crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the pioneer of their suffering, of their salvation, perfect through suffering. So Jesus died because of something to do with suffering, and that in turn was the unique qualification which entitled him to be crowned with glory and honor, and to exercise all power. The 11th verse emphasizes that Jesus is a man like those that he came to save. And suffering is part of our world. It's an inescapable part of it. Now, suffering in a world created by an all-powerful and all-good God is a problem. It's a problem that doesn't go away if you ignore it. It's a problem you can't bury or forget. It's not a problem you can turn aside with facile examples designed to show that people suffer the consequences of their own folly. True though that is, that can't possibly explain all of suffering as we know it on this planet. Well, the first answer to the problem of suffering was the suggestion that suffering is a consequence of sin. Well, this is partly true, but it's only partly true. You can all think of examples of where people who misbehave, as a consequence of their misbehavior, certain things happen to them, which you can say are entirely a consequence of their own actions. And we tend to withhold our sympathy from such people. Alcoholics, for example, the misery that they bring to themselves and to their families. And we say, well, it's really their fault. They ought to give up drinking, put the gin away, and forget about it. Easier said than done if you have never suffered from this kind of illness and have no sympathy for those who have. We tend to treat them rather differently these days. But here is an example that you could give of where consequences follow a certain course of action, and you can say it's the person's fault. He's brought it upon himself. He ought to have known better. All the other pious platitudes that we use, and we don't want to help someone in any practical kind of way. But the real point of this is to try and argue that sin and suffering are a kind of equation. But suffering is always a consequence of sin. Now, that's the extrapolation of the argument which is untrue. And the first time this argument is really seriously challenged is in the book of Job. Job was a righteous man and also a wealthy and prosperous man. A man of substance, a man of power, a happy family man, and a man who stood close to God as well. And when Job lost his health and his strength, his family, his material possessions, and all that he counted dear, and he sat in dust and ashes and scraped these foul ulcers that developed on his body with a potsherd to try and gain some relief, he wondered about the relationship between sin and suffering. His three friends had no hesitations at all. They came and they began very gently, but they pointed out that the righteous did not suffer like this. That if someone suffered in this way, then you could guarantee it was because he had sinned. And therefore what Job ought to do was to confess his sin, not necessarily to them. They were very generous about this. They didn't confess it to them, confess it to God, and then all would be well. And Job would be restored to his health and his strength, and perhaps even his family restored to him again. And Job was unwilling to accept this. For though Job knew that he was not someone who could say he was entirely without sin, he did say he had not sinned in any way that deserved this kind of punishment. He asked perhaps the most futile question that we can ask of God: what have I done to deserve this? And he could find no satisfactory answer. And so he begins to argue that perhaps God has made a mistake. Somewhere there's been a miscarriage of justice. And if only he could argue with God on equal terms, if only it were possible to bring God to a court of law where you could argue with God as a plaintiff does with another before an impartial judge, Job was sure he would be vindicated. His case would be established. His three friends, outraged at this impertinence, then begin to suggest the kind of sins that Job has committed. He has robbed the fatherless. He has taken bread out of the mouths of the widow. He has broken the arm of the poor. And so they go on suggesting to Job the things he must have done, or he wouldn't be in this condition. And finally the Lord himself breaks in and says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" And the equation between sin and suffering is broken once for all in the book of Job. And suffering is seen as being part of God's purpose for man, irrespective of the particular sins that you may or may not have committed. It's part of God's larger purpose for the disciplining, for the spiritual education of his children. Hard though it seems, that is in fact the case. And this was certainly the case with Job, because at the end he said, "Once have I spoken, yea, twice, but I will lay my hand upon my mouth. I had heard of thee with the hearing of the ear, but now mine eyes seeth thee." As a result of suffering, Job's understanding of God was enlarged and deepened in a way that could not have been achieved by any other means. And Job came to understand God in a way so different from his former understanding, it was like sight as compared with hearsay. The prophet Jeremiah was a lonely and a sensitive man, not a man combative and given to argument, loving a good scrap like some men are, but a man who'd rather live quietly at home and leave philosophy and debate and argument to others who had a taste for it. That wasn't his line. And God commissioned him as a prophet to go to Israel with a very unpopular message. A message that said that the Babylonians who come against the city of Jerusalem will take the city, will throw down the temple, and carry off the precious religious ornaments and utensils of that temple away to Babylon. He was the world's first fifth columnist, so all his friends thought. And so they plotted against his life. They pointed out that only 2 centuries before, God had seen fit to defend Jerusalem against the Assyrians. Why did Jeremiah not have faith that God would do the same again? And yet Jeremiah stuck to his guns. He was finally thrown into a dungeon, full of slime, up to his armpits, so it would be impossible to sleep. To sleep would be to drown. So you had to stand there, in the best way possible, in order to keep alive. And this man, outraged at the way that God had treated him, said to God, "You are like the waters of a deceitful brook. You have deceived me. You have betrayed me. You've let me down. I don't deserve to suffer like this." And he was right. He didn't deserve to suffer like that. That wasn't the point of his experience. What Jeremiah learned in that dungeon, and when the men of his own city plotted against his life, was what loneliness was. And in turn, what fellowship with God meant. Fellowship with God didn't necessarily mean meeting with a whole group of other people who held the same beliefs. It could be a matter of the individual conscience of a man and the way his heart was with regard to God. And Jeremiah learned in the bitterness of his own experience what fellowship with God was on an individual basis, and that was the heart of true religion. But the message of Jeremiah saved the religion of Israel from extinction, because everyone else in that day believed that the temple was an essential part of Jewish religion, and that when the temple was destroyed, if that could ever be conceived of even, then religion would come to an end. And Jeremiah, in his own experience, saw it differently. And he learned from suffering. Hosea was another prophet of God, commanded to love a woman who was a persistent adulteress. He didn't just marry her as a token act of obedience. He loved her. And whenever she played false and ran off with someone else, he would go after her and try and bring her back. This man went through agony in his personal life. But the outcome of that was that he began to understand God's concern for faithless Israel, and something of God's feelings when Israel persistently played false with the religion entrusted to their care. Suffering, then, is part of God's purpose for the perfection of his children. And when you doubt this, as inevitably one day you will, as a result of personal experiences, then look at Jesus. For here is a man who led a perfect life, in a sense in which Job and Jeremiah and Hosea couldn't possibly compare. Here was a man who led a perfect life, who did nothing but good to everyone with whom he came in contact, who healed the sick by the hundred, if not the thousands, who raised the dead, who fed the hungry, whose concern was always for others, and yet he was crucified. He was taken and nailed to a cross and allowed to die. Why? It was fitting that he for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through suffering. And in chapter 5, the same writer says, in verse 7, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard for his godly fear. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. So when you're faced with the problem of suffering, there are no merely intellectual considerations that will get you out of the dilemma of why suffering comes to a world created by a beneficent and all-powerful creator. All that you can do is to go to the foot of the cross and look up into the face of Jesus Christ, and you will behold there the glory of God. And that's the only answer that I have for you about the problem of suffering. But I think it's an important answer. And it throws light on why Jesus died. It was necessary that the author and captain of our salvation should taste of all of human experiences to the full, particularly suffering. And he suffered unto death. And being made perfect, he is able to help us in our own times of trouble. This, then, is one of the reasons why Jesus Christ was crucified. There's another reason, also given in Hebrews 2. Look at verse 14. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same nature, that through death he might destroy him who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong bondage. There are more acres of nonsense being written about this argument than perhaps any other in the whole of the Bible. And generations of commentators have asked us to believe that Jesus, through death, destroyed him who had the power of death, that is the devil, means that Jesus was somehow in conflict with some supernatural being called the devil, and that through death, in a way utterly mysterious, he destroyed the devil. Well, it was H.G. Wells who pointed out on one occasion in one of his books, there's something very odd with this argument, that if God and the devil are in conflict, and both are persons, and the devil somehow induces God to allow his son to hang upon the cross, then that's a victory for the devil, not a victory for God. Only if God had managed to persuade the devil's son to be crucified would that have been a victory for God. But seen as a conflict between persons, this is a knockout blow for the devil. And there's a lot to be said for this particular point. Because, of course, the Bible is not, in fact, talking about any kind of supernatural person at all when it talks about the devil. A clue to the meaning of the devil is given you in this chapter. Look at verse 16. Surely it is not with angels that he is concerned, but with the descendants of Abraham. Therefore he had to be made like his brethren in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make expiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered and been tempted, he is able to help those who are tempted. And this is what the devil is about in the Bible. The notion of temptation. Those tendencies within us towards sin and disobedience that we encounter all too often. To understand the devil in Scripture, you need look no further than human nature. And so the writer emphasizes the humanity of Jesus. Jesus was tempted in all points as we are. There were early Christians, they became known as Gnostics, who thought of Jesus as being a kind of angel in disguise. He looked like a man, but he wasn't really a man. But he was some kind of demiurge, was the technical name they used of him, disguised in human form. And this is nonsense. And the writer of the Hebrews says that it's nonsense. Jesus is not concerned with angels, not even wrestling with supposedly fallen angels. He's concerned with the sons and descendants of Abraham. And because of this, he not only suffers like the sons of Abraham have done, but he is also tempted. And because he was tempted, he is able to help all of us who in temptation surrender, as it were, to the devil. Now we're told that Jesus was tempted in all points like as we are, and this is true. But he was also tempted in many more ways of which we have little or no conception. When at the beginning of his ministry he was uncertain as to how to conduct that ministry, he goes into the wilderness, and there we're told in the graphic language of Scripture he was tempted of the devil for 40 days. And here we see Jesus in inner conflict as to what he should do. And one of the temptations, you remember, was the devil is alleged to say, if you fall down and worship me, all these kingdoms, all the kingdoms of the world, will be yours. Now you can only make sense of this if you see the real significance of it. If this were a personal being talking to Jesus, this is not a real temptation, because the kingdoms of the world were not his to bestow. A temptation to be a temptation must be a real option. If it isn't an option, then it's simply no temptation. If someone came to me and said, if you do this, you can be king of the world, this wouldn't be a temptation because it would be ridiculous. There is no way in which I could ever become king of the world. How could that be a temptation? It would be a joke or someone off his head, one or the other. But what is happening here? Jesus, in debate with himself, knowing who he was and from whence he came as the Son of God, which way should he go to achieve the dominion that was rightfully his as part of his inheritance? Should he seek it by following self-seeking ways? Should he take an easy road that would lead to the kingdom being his? Or should he follow the way that he believed God had marked out for him in the Old Testament? A way that involved self-abnegation, self-denial, suffering, and finally, a particularly agonizing death. The kingdoms of the world were offered to him, and this was a genuine temptation, and he turned them down on those terms. When Peter drew a sword and would have defended his Lord against those who came to arrest him, Jesus said, "Don't you know that I could ask my Father, and he would send me more than 12 legions of angels?" Now that must have been true. And if that were true, it means that Jesus could have called upon the heavenly hosts at any time in what followed. Now again, think of the temptation here. If you or I were overpowered by a band of armed men and carried away, there's nothing you can do about it. If they want to crucify you, cut your head off, whatever, what can you do about it? They simply have power over you. You can't do a thing about it. But imagine being in the position of being able to call upon more than 12 legions of angels at any time and not doing it. That's the kind of temptation that Jesus suffered, of which we have no conception. When he was dying on the cross, the leaders of the Jews, who should have known better, came to taunt him. And they said, "If you're the Messiah, step down from the cross, and then we'll believe." And he could have done just that, had he so chosen. But he did not. He refused at all times any way that meant pleasing himself, rather than obeying the will of his Father. When he was with the presence of his disciples, they forsook him, they fled, one of them stayed behind only to deny him three times with a stream of fishermen's oaths. And Jesus showed no sense of revenge, only forgiveness and understanding. There was no bitterness, which could well have been legitimately his, had he been that kind of person. Yes, Jesus was tempted then, as we are, and in so many more ways of which we have little conception. But he never gave in. He never surrendered. Well, how did he then, through death, destroy him that had the power of death? How can we sharpen this to answer this particular question? Well, the death of Christ was the culmination of a life of obedience to God and of total denial of self. When in the garden he prayed in agony that the cup might pass from him, meaning that he might not have to endure this experience of death, no sooner had the words crossed his lips then he said, "Not my will, but thine be done." He turned the other cheek when he was struck by those unworthy to loose the shoes off his feet. When he was reviled, he reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not. The women who wept over him had need to weep for themselves, Jesus said, because of what was coming on Jerusalem. As a lamb before his shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. Now the point that the Bible is making is that self and self-seeking are the cause of our estrangement from God. This is why there is this gulf between God and man, because man wishes to go his way and not God's way. And in so doing, we confirm the rightness of the sentence of death. The devil, in fact, is simply self personified. And what Scripture means by saying that through death he destroyed him that had the power of death, he means that in the cross of Christ, Jesus finally defeated all the forces of self, all the tendencies to go one's own way and not the way of God. And in so doing, he is able to deliver all those who through fear of death are subject to bondage. Now, Jesus himself has something to say about this. Let's look at the 8th chapter of Mark's Gospel. Jesus has asked his disciples, "Whom do men say that I am?" And the disciples went through the list of current speculations. Some say you're Elijah, risen again from the dead, or come back again. Some say you're John the Baptist, risen from the dead, and so on. "Whom do you say that I am?" And Peter, with a God-given wisdom, says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of God." And then in verse 34, Jesus says this. He called to him the multitude with his disciples. Or let me read verse 31 first of all. Having elicited from Peter this confession of his sonship and messiahship, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. What a career for the Messiah. Surely the Messiah was going to be a military figure, a commander who would overthrow Roman garrisons and destroy with the breath of his lips whole Roman armies. And Jesus says nothing at all about that, but talks of rejection, of suffering, of death, followed by resurrection. No wonder this was too much for Peter. Peter couldn't take this. "This shall not be to thee, Lord. How can the Messiah undergo these experiences?" And then verse 34. He called to him the multitude and his disciples and said to them, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? For what can a man give in return for his life?" So Jesus says two things of importance here. And that is that being the Messiah entails that he must take a path that leads through suffering to death. That's the first thing. That's why the notion of a suffering Messiah to this very day is to the Jews a stumbling block. It seems incomprehensible to them. But that's how Jesus interprets the Messiahship of the Old Testament. Being the Messiah, being the Son of God, true, he was both. They were his titles, rightfully his from birth. And that meant rejection, suffering, shame, and a humiliating death. That was the way that he would go back to the Father with all of that that meant in the words of Scripture. That's the first thing that Jesus says. And the second thing is that for any who would be his disciple, then this is the path that they must tread. If anyone would be a follower of Christ, they too must deny themselves. That is the devil which Christ destroyed in his death. They must make that life part of their own experience. Through the grace of God, it doesn't take us to literal crucifixion. We are not required to be nailed to a wooden cross of some sort and there suffer the death that Jesus Christ suffered. But we are nevertheless to take the same attitude to life that he took, to take up the cross, to deny self, which means giving up the works of the devil and destroying in our own lives that which was destroyed in the life of Jesus Christ. And those who do this will be fellows with Christ and heirs of the salvation that is promised. For what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Suffering and death, denial of self, became essentially part of the mission and message of Jesus Christ. It is no less so for his disciples.